especially those with an academic bent, often speak about, quote, art scroll history. Art scroll hardly invented it. But when they say art scroll history, they mean not history, but hagiography. Lives of the saints, where the rabbinic world is heaven on earth, Gedolim love each other and spread Torah. The biographies are story after story of the great things accomplished by Gedolim. You'll never find a Gadol portrayed in a way that might show that he had a fault or, you know, something like that. Now, the authors of these books know that the Gedolim had faults, but they don't think it's respectful to point them out. That was the problem with Kamenetsky's book. Kamenetsky thinks just the opposite. He thinks if you are afraid to point it out, that's because you think people will see these faults and they'll look down on the Gedolim. That means you don't respect the Gedolim, because you don't recognize who that they are real people, like everyone else. Be that as it may, that was Kamenetsky's problem. It can be said that this is a form of censorship, in the sense that if you're writing a biography, it's vital not to exclude any information that give a false portrayal. Yet if people go to Art Scroll looking for history, in the sense that it's understood at the university, you'll be misled. For Art Scroll needs to be understood in its own terms. By the same token, when you interview people, as I've done often, for oral history, you must use what they say very carefully, since people often have an agenda, even unconsciously. And it's the same with Art Scroll. And if you think Art Scroll just decided to leave these things out on their own, you're wrong. Stipler, a big gadol, was asked about someone writing a Haredi history of the Haskalah, all the bad things about the Haskalah. Should he write about Shaul Berlin? Shaul Berlin was a rabbi who became a heretic. He forged a book of Tshuvot of the Rush called the Summing Rosh, with all sorts of crazy stuff in it. And the Stipler said, no, don't write about it. And he gave a few reasons. And one of the reasons was, people could be led to spiritual problems if they actually see that a Gadol B'Yisrael was led to heresy. The intellectuals all know the truth. Anyone who studies knows Shaul Berlin, and they know that there were Gedolim who were led to heresy, like Shaul Berlin and other things. But the masses, the simple people, according to the Stipler, must be led to believe that matters are much simpler than they are. They can't be let in on the fact that life is complicated, and even Gedolim have made errors, feuded with one another, etc. Haredi society operates on this assumption. The newspaper Yateid Ne'aman will carefully filter out things that could hurt the faith of the followers in Das Torah. Thus, religious Zionist Gedolim will never be portrayed as Gedolim. They'll be portrayed as Rav, but never Hagon. Because this might lead people to assume that there's an alternate path, which is also good, that there's other Gedolim. No, yes, these are Talmudic scholars, but they're not Gedolim, because a Gadol is only one who follows Das Torah. The same goes for Art Scroll, although to a much lesser extent than Israeli Haredi literature. But what are important is that these are decisions made by their Gedolim who have determined that Haredi society is to be structured around an elite that has the information, while the masses are not given access to this information. And that's why the internet is so dangerous, because there's no longer any control on the output of information. Anyone can go to the internet and receive the news directly. The Pravda approach, and it was the editor of the English Yateid who told me that we are like a Pravda newspaper, so it's not just me saying it. The Pravda approach of the Yateid doesn't work in today's day and age. Right now, many of you are probably saying, well, this is outrageous. How is it possible for people to follow the Torah and to believe that the seal of God is truth to consciously distort truth? The Torah tells us, Midvar Shekher Tirchak, keep far from a false matter. Now, the context of the verse is legalistic. Don't lie in court or the like. But the verse has been understood in a much more expansive sense. While Jewish sources have never been as uncompromising when it came to truth as Catholic thinkers or Kant, there is agreement that barring serious reasons, one must tell the truth. Barring serious reasons. There's the rub. It is precisely that Judaism does not insist on complete truthfulness that the door to prevarication is open. And let me explain. There's a famous argument in the Talmud between Beis Hillel and Shammai about a bride. Do you tell a bride she's beautiful if she's not, or only if she is? Beis Shammai says you only tell the truth. Now, I'm not saying you wouldn't say she's not beautiful. He might say she's a beautiful person or whatever, but Beis Hillel says you can bend the truth, tell a white lie for the larger purpose. And everyone knows that we live like Beit Hillel. We hold like him. And how could we live life otherwise? Can you imagine your wife or your friend gets a new dress or a haircut and asks you, how is it? If you actually have to tell the truth all the time? No, we understand it's okay to bend the truth a little bit. And everyone should realize, of course, that the only reason these little white lies work is because there's an assumption, a general expectation that people tell the truth. It's vital for society that such an expectation exists. Otherwise, nothing would be believed. Liars need for there to be this expectation or no one will believe their lies. But we see that there's a heter for telling white lies for the greater good. I don't need a Talmudic passage to tell me that there's a heter for not telling the whole truth. We're going to see this in a few weeks in the Torah. Sarah complains that her master, her husband, is old. And when God repeats this to Abraham, he leaves out that portion. Now, there are probably many of you who are sticklers for historical truth and who are going to be very upset what I'm going to say now. And it may leave more questions than answers. Although the Talmud states that the seal of God is truth, there are many voices in our tradition who have not understood truth as identical with historical truth. You know, a myth can provide great truths and not be historical. There's no need to elaborate on how Jews in the past did not write history for history's sake. But I want to show you is that, surprising as it may seem, conscious distortion in the name of a larger truth is also part of our tradition. Let me explain. The Rambam. I'm not going to repeat what I said 2 years ago. You can buy the CD out there. But he says in the guide that he's going to say things that aren't true, because not everyone needs to know all these truths. He tells you that I don't want to affect the faith of the masses negatively, so I'm not going to say, everything I say is not going to be true. He tells you the Torah itself says things that aren't true, but people need to believe it. God, the Torah says God is angry. God doesn't have emotions. The people, the simple people, need to take this literally. It's true in a certain sense that God responds in a way that if he did get angry, a human would respond like that. But Rambam calls this a necessary truth. It's a noble myth. It's not really true. The masses take it on one level. The intellectuals know the truth is really on the lower level. But the masses are supposed to take it on its outer level, which is not really true. Even in Halakha, in Erevin, there's an amazing text which describes how Rabba and Rav Yosef were on the way, quoting and arguing. And Rabba quoted something in the name of Rav Yosef. And the Gemara says, this wasn't correct. He attributed it to Rav Yosef, but only that because he wanted Rav Yosef to accept it. And this is mentioned by the Magen Avraham, this idea that if you think something's correct, attribute it to a great sage. I mean, this opens a Pandora's box. There's a big scholar who said that, you know, he hopes that Rav Schechter doesn't hold to this Magen Avraham, because then you can't believe anything in a Nefesh HaRav. I actually know of one example of where this principle was not actually applied. The big dispute over whether sturgeon is kosher. To know to be Huda, some of you might know, ruled sturgeon's kosher. And his big Talmud became a Reform rabbi, Aaron Chorin. So Aaron Chorin wrote a whole book defending his teacher, sturgeon's kosher. And this other Rav wrote a whole book against it, in which the other Rav said, you know, the Noda Yehuda wrote me a letter saying he retracted his view. The Noda Yehuda's son, obviously they hated Chorin, but his son and his Talmud, the Tshuva Me'ava, Fleckless, wrote and said, you, Rabbi Grosshaber, wrote this book, you're a liar. Our father never retracted it. So what's going on here? I have no doubt that Grosshaber was lying, but for a good reason. Jews, Klal Yisrael, had accepted that sturgeon was treif. Aaron Chorin, for reformist reasons, was trying to resurrect a rejected heter. Chorin thought, you know, so I'll say that the Noda Yehuda retracted. I don't know, though, if the Chasam Sofer would have such a negative view as the Noda Yehuda's son. Because the Chasam Sofer says, in the battle against reform, he coined a phrase. He says, we are lahali. It's okay, lahalot etayisur. He says, we can tell people it's a biblical prohibition, even though it's not. Because, you know, people say, well, it's only Durabanan. You know, the Chasam Sofer says if it's going to keep him from doing it, tell him it's a biblical prohibition, even though we know it's not. And this created a big machlokas between him and other gedolim. Can you lie? Can you misrepresent the truth for larger purposes? It continues to this day. If you read the Frimmer's article on women's prayer groups, they have a whole appendix there on misrepresenting the Torah for larger purposes. And they quote the machlokas. The Chasam Sofer on one side, Maariv Chayes on another, because this is relevant to women's prayer groups, because a lot of Rabbanim said it's usher. I mean, that derisa and all that, and they said, well, Are you allowed? Let's say you don't really believe it's Usser, but you, for public policy reasons, you have to say it's Usser. Can you make these things up? And they have a whole discussion. Rav Chaim David Halevi was very much against this. And he points out correctly, I think, although this is not a halachic argument, once you find out that your rabbi is telling you things are Usser, when they're really not Usser, you know, he's not just saying, you know, it's not Usser, but I don't think it's a good idea. That destroys rabbinic authority completely. You know, what's the point? But it's the machlokas. You know, this is so much a part. There's two, basically, you have two conceptions of truth telling. Some rabbis see it at absolute value, with certain exceptions, as we noted. You know, if not to hurt someone's feelings. While others see truth as simply instrumental, to be put aside very easily. The modern outlook is very opposed to the seeing truth as instrumental. We insist on historical accuracy. It's so much a part of our education. The insistence on transparency and accuracy in every field of endeavor. It's also why it's so unusual, but not unheard of, for modern Orthodox scholars, educated in the modern fashion, to consciously cover up facts or distort. Obviously, non-conscious distortions abound. But as a group, and there'll be exceptions, the Haredi world doesn't have this interest in historical accuracy for the sake of historical accuracy. And certainly not with presenting facts to the population. Rabbi Schwab has a famous essay on this, that what's the point of history? Why do we need to know? The point of history is not to know the facts of the past. The point of history is to inspire. And therefore we take out that which doesn't inspire. He doesn't say you actually make up stuff. He just says you take out. But it's a short step from there. If mentioning certain matters will reflect negatively on the current Das Torah in the Haredi world, then of course this has to be censored. Obviously, I don't share that view, but that's basic to the Haredi society. And let me conclude by showing how this plays out in the real world with what I personally experienced. Some of you know about my writings on Rabbi Weinberg, and it was my article on Rabbi Weinberg and Samuel Atlas that really brought this issue to the fore of how to write history in the Orthodox world. Totally unprepared for the reaction. Totally unintentional on my part. J.J. Schachter wrote a long essay on this afterwards. Much more happened behind the scenes. Now, what was controversial was not the fact that private letters were published. That happens every day. But what was controversial was the contents of the letters. That they showed that he had a close friendship with someone at HUC, that he was troubled by aspects of Jewish law. People were troubled that this was publicized. They didn't want the world to see, to know about this. Now, before my book was published, someone approached me, a yeshivish person, and gave me a bit of advice what I should publish. His goal was to keep Rabbi Weinberg respected in the yeshiva world. He had a problem, he said. I was also publishing the collected writings, and Weinberg wrote a famous essay on Herzl. And he said, you should not publish this essay. He was afraid it would hurt his reputation in the yeshiva world, and that Rabbi Weinberg would want us, you know, to be in the yeshiva world. He said to me in all seriousness that I, as a modern Orthodox Jew, if that's what I am, should be interested in securing Weinberg's reputation in the yeshiva world. You know, today Weinberg is part of their canon, he's valued by them, and therefore he's an example of a liberal, open-minded gadol. And as a modern Orthodox Jew, it would be a real shame if because of something I published, he was now out of that canon. Because it opens up liberalizing possibilities for that community, which presumably I would want. He thought that since I wouldn't censor material for his reasons, I of course would censor it for my reasons. Because he assumed, I guess, that everyone censors. And he tried to show me how it was in my interest and modern Orthodoxy's interest to censor this. My reply to him, which I don't know if he understood, was that as a modern Orthodox Jew, I indeed think it's important that Weinberg is part of the yeshiva canon. I only wish the Rav was as well. But while it's important to me, historical truth is more important. And while therefore I will publish the essay on Herzl, which Weinberg himself published twice in Hebrew and once in Yiddish, and discusses his views of Zionism, and if as a result he becomes persona non grata in the extreme Haredi world today, so be it. He didn't, but I mean, if he did, so be it. It's not my job as a historian to make all sorts of calculations about what will help or hurt the reputation of the man I'm studying in certain segments. And by the same token, if on his deathbed, Weinberg became a Satmar Chassid, and this would totally destroy his sense, the iconic view of him in the modern Orthodox world, I would publish that as well. And if not, I might as well find a different career. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the interests of time, we have a few minutes for questions. I'd ask that you direct them directly to Dr. Shapiro, and we'll give him an opportunity to respond.
Thank you. Say again. Doesn't it make us very likely by the time of Masorah? That was the question. Shaky. What does it mean by Masorah? If Masorah means to be a firm Jew, to observe Torah mitzvos, then is it really important, you could argue, to know, what size Kiddush cup the Chafetz Chaim had? It could be that the historical enterprise is at odds with some traditional conceptions. I personally don't believe it. But history uncovers things that are problematic. I don't think it's at odds with the Masorah, per se. The question is, what do you mean by Masorah? If Masorah means historical truth, yes. Yeah. No. Look, obviously every historian has their biases, and we show. But the idea that a historian would purposely hide something for personal or communal gain is so rare that when it is discovered, it's a scandal of immense proportions, be it plagiarism, be it something else. This is scandalous, and it's very rare. I mean, I've lived my whole life among historians. It's the end of your career when something like this happens. People do not publish manuscripts, leave out things because the Vatican might be upset or something. That's the whole point. You find something like that. What Stitzkin did is like really unheard of, and you do not find this. Historians do not consciously censor material. Unconsciously, there's always distortions, but to consciously cover up things, I mean, that's a fraud. That's a fraudulent person. That's a fraud. Yeah. You're correct in that sense. The question is, orthodoxy, as it's used in the academy, is a response to reform. So obviously, orthodoxy is not just traditional Judaism. And orthodoxy today is not traditional Judaism to a large extent because we've made changes, more chumrah or more mako. But that doesn't change the fact that every society changes, even pre-modern society changes. Orthodoxy, though, what the Chacham himself was saying was consciously, we raise certain things to higher levels. And we don't want the people to know, because what's more important? That the masses know whether it's a Rabbana Deraisa or that they live Torah lives. Okay, one more question from Rabbi. Two more questions. Yeah. I wrote about that in the book. Another example, the same people who published this stuff from Hirsch, which I showed you, Netzach, they published an essay of Weinberg, and they took out stuff from that essay. Because they want Weinberg's essay. He's a gadol, but they don't really want what he says. So, yes, Weinberg has been victim as well. One more question, yeah. I have to go to the airport, yeah, so... Thank you.
And yet, I have a bit of a problem in listening to you, or listening to some comments. We live in a different world. I grew up in a world where, indeed, in secular studies, or even outside of Judaic studies, we didn't wear yarmulke. It's a different world. Boy-girl relationship was entirely different. In our days, we didn't know at 15 about pills. Maybe they didn't even exist. We live in a different world. And therefore, to undress history isn't always in our best interest. We live in a very defensive way. Orthodoxy, even though it has grown a lot because of birth rate and Torah learning and Lakewood and Mir, nevertheless, our youth is in constant danger. Going out into the street, reading the media, looking at television, and therefore, without twisting truth and without going overboard in denying truth, I think we ought to be a little more cautious than would be indicated in the way you analyze the situation.
And that's certainly a position that's which is a common position. And obviously when you raise children, you know, there's certain things, you don't tell them everything. But, I mean, the other question is, are people's faith so shallow that if they were heard that in Germany they didn't wear yarmulkes, what's going to happen? All of a sudden that's going to be the end of Yiddishkeit? But again, I'm a historian, so I assume that people know. I don't go into Bnei Brak and give them a book to read, but I assume that people who are intellectually curious, you know, if people want to be part of that community, I'm not saying what they're doing is wrong, even. They choose to live in that community. Those are the ground rules. But I do think it's interesting to point out what the leaders of that community feel their people are able to take. And the idea, and it enters the realm of Bizayon HaTorah, I think, as well. Because if you're going to say that today Rav Kook is not accepted, therefore it's okay to degrade him and deny the fact that the Gedolei Yisrael related to him positively, it's a very slippery slope. Because once you start denying this fact, then all of a sudden you can start denying that fact. You know, it's a very slippery slope. And then, in Ladav Arsof, because who becomes the self-appointed censor? I don't know where it ends. And it ends up biting the same people who begin. I understand your concerns, and I'm not going into Bnei Brak and, you know, revealing any secrets. I'm speaking to an intellectually aware audience so that they be aware of how a different segment of our community thinks, and that there are indeed Torah sources to support this. I'm not denying that. Thank you.